Good morning and welcome. We are so fortunate to have as our first speaker in this Peace and Justice series, Karen Ahrens. And we all want to welcome her. And I will just introduce her and then she will take over and start us with prayer. Karen is a registered dietitian whose experience includes administration of school lunch programs and coordinating North Dakota's statewide anti-hunger coalition. She's gained hands-on understanding of how policy affects people in her community as a volunteer growing food for donation to food pantries, serving meals in soup kitchens, and delivering meals to seniors and those with health conditions. She has served as an elder in the First Presbyterian Church in Bismarck, North Dakota, and recently relocated to Washington, D.C., all the way from North Dakota, for her new job in federal nutrition policy advocacy. Won't you please welcome Karen Ahrens?
Good morning, everyone. I'm so pleased to be with you here today. I wish I were with you in person. But we'll take Zoom while we can. Let us pray. Creator God, thank you for bringing us all here together today. Thank you for the time and efforts of the Peace and Justice team for their thoughtful planning. May all of us learn from one another and from you. May our ears and our hearts, our hands and our feet, and our brains and our mouths be put to use to serve those on the margins and those within our own circle. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, I also wanted to start us out on with a multimedia presentation. So if you advance to the next slide, please, Ted. I wanted to share with you this artwork who was done by a girl from Central America who I met briefly when I was on a trip to El Paso and Ciudad Juarez on the cusp of the pandemic to learn more about immigration and the people who are trying to come to our country. And her artwork and my experiences inspired this short poem that I'll share. We are all here. Our lives are bound together. There is no them but us. How then to get past or to and, past versus to with us? Together, together. See the eyes, offer a hand, pass the bread. Together, together, walk a mile, sing a song, mumble a prayer, together, together. Next slide. We have a short time together. There's a lot to discuss in the area of food, food security, food insecurity. But I hope to bring some information to help you understand, find direction, take action, and maybe even make you feel a little uncomfortable. With the next slide, I will bring forth this verse from Micah. And whenever I hear these words, I also think of the song that you might also be familiar with. So to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Next slide. So a few definitions to help us be on the same page, make some things more clear, or maybe a little muddy, but hopefully more clear. On the next slide, I talk about hunger. Zoom. I just learned that Zoom doesn't pick up music, but blocks it. So I played the song, and hopefully some of you who know it were humming along. What does the Lord require of you? Hunger is a physical sensation, a condition of hunger. A technical definition is that hunger is discomfort, illness, weakness, or pain caused by prolonged involuntary lack of food. But hunger is sometimes shorthand for the following terms that have more technical definitions. But even a congresswoman that I met said, I just say hunger because people understand that. On the next slide, it's the definition for food security and food insecurity. So food security means that a household has all the members in it have enough food at all times for an active, healthy life. And it includes ready availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods. So foods that aren't spoiled or tainted in some way. And that there's ability to acquire foods in socially acceptable ways, like without dumpster diving, for example, or scavenging or stealing or turning to other coping strategies. So food insecurity means that there's limited or uncertain availability of safe and adequate foods, or the limited ability to acquire foods. On the next slide, there are different shades of food insecurity. At the top, so when someone is considered food secure, means they can afford enough healthy food every day. And then gradations of people becoming food insecure, where they might worry about where their next meal is coming, or worry at the end of the month that there would be enough money to buy food for your family. People use coping strategies to, like, reducing the quality and variety of their diets. Shopping sales or shopping foods that are have less nutrition quality, but they're less expensive. And often in those circumstances too, there's less variety in a diet. As the situation becomes more grave and the condition is described as very low food security, adults may cut back on the food they're eating to make sure that their children have enough to eat. And when things are very bad, even the food intake of children in the household is low, inadequate, not enough. So I think a lot of you who are here today are very concerned and want to make sure that the most vulnerable in our society, like our children, our elders, people who have served in our military, all people with disabilities, all have enough to eat. Just everyone. The title of your series is Enough Healthy Food for Everyone. The next slide. There's a bit of nuance here in the CEO of Feeding America, which is the national network of food banks. And a quote from her that I had to stop and think about for a while is that the nuance is that some people are not food insecure because they have access to charitable food system. They have access to a food cupboard, a food shelf, community meals with no charge. But that doesn't mean they have enough, or it doesn't necessarily result in that people are self-sufficient when they have to rely on those types of situations to get enough food. I am very blown away by the charity, the donations, the time and the talents and the money that are donated to charitable feeding networks. But there's something that makes a lot of people's eyes open on the next slide. So if you were to imagine that all the food assistance in our nation was set up into 20 bags, only one of those 20 bags comes as a result of our charitable food systems, only one in 20. And the rest of food assistance that helps make sure that people have enough to eat comes from the federal nutrition programs. So what are those federal nutrition programs on the next slide? Well, probably the most common one is SNAP, formerly known as food stamps. And SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which helps make sure that people with low incomes can purchase foods at grocery and food stores, big box stores, with assistance that goes on a card like your credit card. It's called an EBT card. And people have to go through a rigorous application for that, where their sources of income, their household size, the assets that they have are all examined to make sure they fall within the program qualifications. So that is SNAP, and it serves about 40 million people in our nation. A program that goes along hand in hand with SNAP that a lot of people don't know about is called SNAP Education. SNAP Ed programs are often run out of university extension programs, and they do a few things. A colleague of mine who works in this area said SNAP Education, you can relate to that old parable of giving a person to fish, a fish, which they might receive going through the line at a soup kitchen. But SNAP Education helps to teach people to fish, and it also makes sure people have their fishing poles and they know how to use them. And it also takes a look at the pond to make sure the pond is well stocked and it's kept up. So SNAP educators work across many areas to make sure that the food systems are set up better, like maybe helping put in place a farmer's market or helping make sure that the farmer's market accepts SNAP benefits. So SNAP education is an unsung but also important component of the SNAP program. Another well-known program is the Women, Infants, and Children's program known as WIC, serving women who are pregnant, women who have just given birth, and their children up until the age of 5. And so with this program, women get some supplemental foods that are based on their nutritional needs, as well as their children's. For example, foods that are high in iron. Fruits and vegetables are an important part of this because they're lacking in the diets of all Americans, but especially people with not a lot of resources. They are great at helping people access other kinds of things that they might need through referrals and helping mothers breastfeed. So WIC, another important program. Federal nutrition programs also include meals that are served to children at childcare centers, childcare homes, and in schools. There are summer meal programs and snack programs and even dinner programs. So the child nutrition programs are an important part of it. The thing that was terrible about the COVID pandemic is that so many people's incomes were impacted. The great thing about the pandemic is how our nation responded to help people have enough food. The official federal statistics showed that there really wasn't much of an uptick in the official food insecurity rate because we put up programs that help people get enough food to eat during the pandemic, and it just ended at the end of the last school year. School meals were just part of the school day. Every child who went through the line at school just got a meal without any charge to the family or the parents. And that was an important part of helping make sure that children had enough to eat when our economic situation was so topsy-turvy. And it worked so well that a lot of people, including me, would like to help keep that going to make sure that school meals like a bus ride or a book or a desk become a part of the school day, just as those more traditional things we think of. And 7 states have approved healthy school meals for all. There are federal food programs that take food to people directly. There's called TFAP, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, a commodity supplemental food program that helps mainly get food to seniors. There is the food distribution program on Indian reservations that helps get food to remote areas and often to people who have low incomes or low opportunities for jobs. And then there are senior meals, meals that are home delivered and meals where people go to eat together. And they get not only the food, but also the social engagement. Okay, so that's the alphabet soup of, I think I got most all the federal nutrition programs. So during this session, I know that the planners wanted to make sure that there were opportunities to take action. So an idea for action is to support healthy school meals for all in your community, in your state, or vote for those people who represent you in Congress, in the House, and the Senate, who support these kind of programs. While they're running for office, you could ask them, do you support these programs? Or if you find out that they're trying to make it harder for people to access food, consider about if you want to vote for them again or not. Bread for the World has a program for advocacy called An Offering of Letters, which helps people in congregations of all kinds in the church write letters to Congress. Next slide. Okay, I wanted to let you know about a new thing that's been come up over the last 2 years or so. So we're not just focusing on food, but also on nutrition. And the new term is nutrition security. So nutrition security means that we all have consistent and equitable access to healthy, safe, and affordable foods that are essential to being healthy and being well, and that the foods are available if needed to also treat diseases, some of those chronic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and particularly among people of racial and ethnic minorities, people with lower incomes, and people living in remote and rural populations. So nutrition security has come into play because it's been noted, finally, that what we eat has a big impact on our health. And for the first time ever in the last year or so, diseases caused by poor nutrition, like those chronic diseases of cancer, diabetes, and heart disease, have overtaken, so poor nutrition causes of death have overtaken smoking as the leading causes of death in our nation. So this is why nutrition security has been raised up to a higher level of attention, awareness, and action. Next slide. Just a little bit more on the connection between people with less access to healthy food and chronic diseases. So people with lower incomes, lower socioeconomic status, as it goes in the jargon, people in racial or ethnic minorities have a poor diet quality. And so they are more apt to experience adverse health outcomes like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and diet-related cancers, and also be at increased risk for disease and death. And food and nutrition insecurity are linked to all of these things among people who don't have a lot of financial resources. Next slide. I don't expect you to read all this, but I did want to show you that the diseases that are associated with chronic disease, the chronic disease associated with food insecurity are many, from asthma and iron deficiency anemia in children to things like higher impact of arthritis. It's linked to hypertension. It's linked to less physical activity, because if you're not eating well and eating foods that bring you good health, you're less able to be physically active. And then in older adults, it's linked to depression, high blood pressure again, osteoporosis, and all kinds of things that help, that contribute to higher or worse incidence of the diseases if they get them. So lots of ways that food insecurity impact our health. Next slide. And I was doing a little bit of research about your congregation here, and look at you. You are engaged as a congregation in so many things. I just put a few of them up here on the slide: the City Mission, South Hills Interfaith Movement, Rise Against Hunger, Community Farm, and others that I didn't post on here. And I wanted to call out your efforts in so many areas and congratulate you for taking action already. On the next slide. Getting back to our theme of justice and some of one of the well-known verses from Matthew 25 is the righteous will answer him, "When was it that you saw hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it you saw a stranger welcomed you naked and gave you clothing? And when you saw someone who was sick and you visited them, or someone in prison and you visited them?" And the familiar verse, "Truly I tell you, as you did it to one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did it to me." So in helping us think of justice and relating it back to the words that we study in the Bible. And just to, some encouragement to help keep us going. Next slide. I also did a little bit of looking in the city of Pittsburgh and found out, do you really have a neighborhood called Squirrel Hill? I thought that was kind of cute. Not so funny that there's a pretty high rate of food insecurity in the Pittsburgh area, in that 1 in 5 of your residents faces food insecurity. And I bring a question to which there might not be one answer, or you might not know the answer, but there's some ideas about why are there large areas of the city without grocery stores where it's hard to access food? Does anyone have any thoughts or insights about that?
If you're online, please feel free to unmute if you want to offer some thoughts, and I'm here for the folks. And here we go, Dan Paul.
Yeah, the community I know the most about is Homewood, and it used to be a prosperous community 40, 50 years ago, and now is the poorest community in Pittsburgh. And all the grocery stores have left over the years because people can't afford to buy food there. As a result, they end up going to food marts that are, you know, sell things that you can eat, but they're not helping. And my guess is, if you go to the areas that have the most, we call them food deserts, you'll find there's a high level of poverty. They pretty well go together.
All right. You have some experience in this area. Thank you for sharing that example of grocery stores leaving places that are less prosperous areas. Other thoughts, ideas from anyone else?
Online, feel free to unmute. Anybody here in the chapel? Want to pipe up? Don't be shy. Karen won't bite. Here we go.
I can't even get to you.
Lack of investment in economically depressed areas.
I'm sure that zoning has something to do with that. I can imagine some of the areas in the East End, for example, and I don't mean the poor areas. Find a grocery store out there. You've got to drive over to the Parkway East area, for example, get to the Giant Eagle if you live in Regent Square in that area. So it may be a zoning issue, but that's less consequential than the previously mentioned causes.
Thank you. Good point.
If I could just comment, but I don't want to interrupt. Okay. I hope this doesn't sound like a rationalization rather than an understanding, but one of the things that I've observed is the distinction between the really large sort of corporate chain stores like a Giant Eagle or a Shop and Stave or so forth, and small mom and pop stores. For example, in Squirrel Hill, there are a lot of small mom and pops. In fact, they may be very specific, like bakery, butcher shop, so forth. And I think that there are areas in which that's linked with culture and handing down one economy from another in terms of generations. So again, I mean, it's not an excuse. There's a real issue, but encouraging entrepreneurial small activities might also be a part of that whole issue with the nutrition.
I love that. It's related. I share with you a couple of examples from rural, the middle of the nation. So like you mentioned, these food marts, which I imagine are small corner stores that have a little bit of everything. Things are probably sold at a pretty high price when it comes to grocery. And the foods that have high profit margins, like highly processed foods, might be on the shelves there, a little less costly. The same thing happens not just in the cities, but also in the rural areas of our nation. We've had small independent grocery stores closing down because they are not able to make enough to keep going. And part of that is the increased cost that it takes to get the distribution of food to those areas. That they buy in smaller quantities, which relates to your comment about the corporate stores versus the smaller stores that purchase in smaller volumes. So the smaller stores don't get volume discounts. Their food is more expensive, so people stop shopping there, and then it just becomes this circle down to the drain. But there is more funding, more ideas, more realization, I think, at the federal level and investment in some of the small entrepreneurial businesses, and especially businesses run by people from communities or minorities that have been disadvantaged for so long, but helping them get some grants or loans to help them start and maintain businesses, small entrepreneurial businesses. So if you want to, this dashboard that your city has, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the, we're working on something that you just mentioned in Homewood that's called a food cooperative, whereby it's not the big corporate stores that care about profit, but it's run by residents of the community and funded with grants. And the goal is to make it a full-fledged grocery store, but it's without the profit motive.
Wonderful. Your city planning department, I'm trying to remember the Google term I used. City food access planning in Pittsburgh has this nifty map online that's interactive so that you can click on various areas of the community and learn more sometime when you're Googling around the internet there. Thank you for sharing those insights and things that are happening in Pittsburgh. Okay, next slide. I just wanted to delve a little bit deeper into the ways that food insecurity and other conditions, they are present in every county of the United States, but they do impact groups of people in different rates. So for example, food insecurity rates among people who look like me, white, non-Hispanic people, and these numbers are national numbers. White non-Hispanic people have food insecurity rates of about 7%, but people who identify as Black or Native American have almost three times those rates at closer to 20%. People identifying as Latino or Pacific Islander, again, close to 20% at right around 17%. And also, if you follow across the screen, you'll see that not only is food insecurity different among different groups of people, but so is median income, rates of home ownership, and rates of poverty. So that people who have more access to better incomes are less likely to be food insecure, less likely to own a home. What are some of the other reasons that people in certain groups don't own homes? In the case of the Black population, you've probably heard of redlining that happened that excluded people from being able to buy homes in certain areas just because of the color of their skin. When it comes to Native American people, the indigenous people to our continent, that their land was taken away through actions of the government through wars. And although treaties were signed, as a nation, we haven't kept our word on the treaties that were signed that in exchange for the land, we were to provide health care and other things, which we haven't kept our end of the deal on. So the things that happened in the past did happen in the past, but they have impacted generations through the results of those actions. And when we know about it, we can act to do something about it. So these conditions, the other disparities, the differences exist for many areas of our lives. And these conditions are known as social determinants of health. Next slide.
Hang on just a second. We have a comment from the floor.
Sure.
Battery went dead, sorry.
Yeah, the line I know most about there is the Black line because of our work in Homewood. And you've got their national averages. If you go to poverty-stricken neighborhoods, and Homewood is the worst in Pittsburgh, the food insecurity line is more than double your 20%. The home ownership line is below 20, you know, more than less than half of your 43. And the median income is in the 20s, so about half of your 46. So the national average covers up the poor, poverty-ridden places.
Thank you. I appreciate that insight. So a root cause, if we go to the next slide of social determinants of health. So where we live, are the opportunities we have to earn money, the access and the quality of our education, the ability to access and the quality of our healthcare, whether we live in some place where the housing is of good condition and there is not pollution or there is pollution, our community connections, all of these things play a role in our health. And so I speak of this because in my line of work as a health professional, these conditions are important. And finally, over the last few years, have people and health systems and insurers are finally understanding the importance of these things, that it's not just about the 10 minutes you spend a year in the doctor's office that contributes to good health or poor health, but all of these things throughout our lives that impact our health. And so a root cause of not enough food is generally not enough resources to obtain food. So it's an economic condition. People experience food insecurity, and these associations between food insecurity, and they reflect underlying inequalities, like the long-standing economic and social disadvantages that resulted from systemic racism. And that's the part where it gets uncomfortable, but I hope to invite you to join in my discomfort with this. And it sounds like some of you are already past that and are working through ways to help improve not only access to food, but many areas of life. On the next slide. So working to help alleviate food insecurity or end food insecurity may look like volunteering at a soup kitchen or a food pantry, but it also might look like child tax credits, fair housing, access to credit, access to scholarships and student loans, equitable tax structures, and to corporate benefits, changes in our immigration policies, livable wages. The Poor People's Campaign with Reverend William Barber works on many of these issues, including food insecurity and many of these other economic issues. And I just give you one example of a coalition that's working on many of these fronts. It's an alliance of national organizations that work together to promote public policies that address the needs of low income and other vulnerable people. So if you'd like to learn more about working across this broad spectrum of human needs and economic security, that's one place to get more information. Next slide. And again, more inspiration, and I encourage you to imagine the voice of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King when he would eloquently not just speak, but pray these words from his mouth, to let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. I imagine that in his voice is so much more impactful. But when we bring all of our voices together to say these words, to work and believe in these things, we can do better together. And I encourage you to take and find courage in these words. And then on the last slide, I leave you with an image of some stained glass windows at the First Presbyterian Church in Bismarck, North Dakota, and some words that through God, with God, in God, we can do more together than we can alone. And so I will finish up with the information that I prepared to share with you, and I will look forward to some discussion, some thoughts, some insights, or other things that might have come to you while I was sharing this information with you.
We have here Bobby
Yes, I just wanted to thank you for putting all this in front of us. You aren't here, so you can't know exactly what we're like, but we are a fairly wealthy suburb with not a lot of contact with people of need. And so it's really good for us to have this set before us as a challenge. We're not new to working on hunger issues, and we have written letters through Bread for the World. So I thank everybody for in this room who probably have done that. Many letters, yes. But it's just good to have all of the threads connected in the way that you did. I thought it was really very helpful. So I personally want to thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Bobby. Also, I would say that the church that I grew up in, although it's in the center of a city, a lot of the people that have been in the church that I've been attending for the past 25 years or so are teachers. They're people who are well educated and kind of sounding like your congregation. And I'm just venturing here, and at 11 o'clock, I'm going to walk down the street to the Church of the Pilgrims here in Washington, D.C., where it is in an area, and they do offer meals to the homeless, to people without homes each Sunday. And I've started to take part in that and get to see how things are like here in B.C.,
Westminster took a group of young people. I was part of that group a couple years ago to that church, and we spent a week there. The thrust of it was the food insecurity that's present in Washington, D.C., and we got to visit the central kitchen. We actually helped prepare food there. On one morning, we helped distribute breakfast items for the homeless. And we heard a person that had experienced homelessness and had overcome that and is an integral part of their system there in Washington, D.C. to not only address the food insecurity, but also homeless issues and their emphasis on housing. But that church, it was just really a great experience for the youth. And I don't know that they do that anymore, though. I think that program has ended, which kind of a sad thing. Oh, maybe you can comment on that.
Yes, I've just been attending a few weeks, but I understand, too, that they decided to end that program, programs like those just can open a lot of eyes. And the program that I went, where I met people trying to immigrate to the United States as refugees, I went on a similar trip and was hosted in a home that had been run by a small Catholic order of priests that had a place of housing for people to come and visit the different places and programs and get a firsthand view of the issues, the people that are working to help, and meet some people.
Yeah, one last comment about that trip. As a follow-on to that, we as a church, our youth program initiated and continues to support preparing food packages, or I shouldn't say food, but these are, what do they call them?
Quick kits
that you can put in your car, and if you're out and about in the city and there's someone that has a need, we use that to distribute. It's more essential items than it is food, but it is a support method that it was a result of that trip. And we continue that to this day.
Yeah, it's wonderful how the ripples can continue. And I hope from the series of speakers that you're bringing that the ripples also continue in new and different ways to help impact more people.
Carol?
I have a question for you with regard to the one slide that you predicted would open some eyes, and it opened mine, that one in 20 of the grocery bags coming from independent programs and the 19 coming from the federal government. First, holy cow. And then second, do you have a sense of the variability of that? Is that on a trajectory of becoming less independent, more federal government, or has it been one in 20 for some time?
That's a good question. That's the first time I'd seen it put that way. So I do know that, I don't know in the past how that's been different. But I do know that since the pandemic, there has been increased need reported by food banks across the United States, and also that the current rates that the schools are reimbursed for providing meals has become to seem like not enough to be able to support healthy meals. Even though the pandemic's over, the public health emergency as the result that was declared because of the pandemic is over, the forces that were set in motion are still not smoothed out. And I don't think they're ever going back to the way that they were. So almost my husband has worked in food service for all of our married life in various congregate settings for people. And these things that were set in motion by the pandemic are still upending the food service, the food preparation and service of meals. So whether it's in a childcare program, a school, a nursing home, a hospital, in all those places, they're feeling these impacts of labor shortages, of higher rates of the cost to get food there, that the cost of distribution, food inflation, disruptions in the supply chain. Those are, you know, when you order something and you plan a menu and you order it and you expect that the food will come so that you can prepare these meals and serve people, not only through those federal government programs, but at a soup kitchen, still disruptions in that supply chain, and people aren't getting in a timely way or at all certain foods that they think to put on their menus. So all of those things are still impacting even our restaurants, right? When we go out to eat, you may see different menus, you may see longer wait times. The food in food service, it's all still kind of really bumpy and not smooth. And so these all are impacting all of the federal nutrition programs too.
Charlotte?
I recently read an article that the largest food chain in today's economy in the U.S. is Dollar General, and that it's expanding much more rapidly than any other stores. I was amazed. And one of the concerns that was raised is about the quality of the food and the breadth of the food. They don't have a wide range. I'm wondering how you see that impacting this whole issue of the security insecurity and where those are particularly located, those types of stores.
Yes. So, as you might guess, these companies are going into places where, and I swear, in North Dakota, there's a few examples of them going into small communities where the grocery store was struggling, and they zoom in there and they stand up these stores very quickly. And they end up because of their ability to buy large volumes at lower prices, undercutting the grocery store, and in a couple of cases have put the traditional independently owned grocery stores out of business. I've tried to go into these Dollar Generals. I won't use any brand names, dollar stores that are springing up, and they do not have a full range of food. So when a grocery store leaves a community or a neighborhood and that store is in its place, there's less variety, less healthful foods available to the people who live nearby. The other thing that I've learned that they do is that they will take, say, the outside box of a Cheerios box, and you're used to buying that size box for your family with, say, 32 ounces in it. But the dollar stores sometimes will use the tactic of taking that same outside shell of a box and putting fewer ounces in it and selling it at a lower price. And so you think you're getting this deal when in fact you're getting less. So I have concerns about the impact of those stores who seem to be fairly predatory in nature when it comes to the market. And there are certain communities or cities or subdivisions of communities that have passed laws against any moratoriums on those kind of stores locating in their areas.
Others online, feel free to chip in. I just have a question for you. I was struck by your chart that showed the different sort of symptoms of social and economic stress in different communities, different racial and ethnic backgrounds. And it strikes me that the relationship between nutrition and health and income and the quality of nutrition is a little bit complex, because some of the social determinants that you talked about relate to social and economic stresses, so that even if you hand people access to food, speaking very broadly, social and economic stresses change the patterns with which they eat, the kinds of foods that they consume, and the healthfulness of the dietary patterns, simply because a person's dietary patterns don't exist in a vacuum. People with limited resources and social stresses feed their children differently, look at the ethnography of the food, the way that food fits into their lives. It just becomes very different, so that some of these foods that we step back and say, well, that's bad nutrition, becomes a positive in terms of the feelings that it generates about, you know, can I give my children a treat, which I ordinarily can't afford. I'd really be interested in your thoughts about that.
Yes, and I am a student of this, and I am learning, and I am working to move forward in my understanding, and also raise up and help give more opportunities for professionals in health in many areas of health who come from these communities, support their education so that they can become health professionals to people who are like them and who have a better understanding. But there is this documentary called High on the Hog, and it's about this young man who traces the roots of slavery back to Africa and the roots of food, Southern ways of cooking. So if you were in a working on a plantation as a slave, and all the food was prepared by Black women for the people that you were enslaved under, as well as the people in your community, the people who you slaved for lived high off the hog. They got the best cuts of meat. And what was left over was what was there to feed your community. And so if hog gels or other, you know, maybe higher fat pieces of the animal were eaten and cooked so they wouldn't go to waste, so that they would feed people who didn't have incomes, became a part of their food ways and traditions. And so then we come along later as health professionals and say, well, this food is so high in fat and you shouldn't be eating it. But it's been part of our family way of eating for all these hundreds of years through this. Another example of that is the tradition of fried bread dough in tribal nations in my area. Fried bread tacos are considered this, it's a celebration food. When my husband worked at a treatment center run by a tribal organization, when they were celebrating something, they wanted to have fried bread, this fried bread. Well, that came about as a celebration food or as a traditional food because of the commodity system, because of the white flour and the lard in a can that was provided to them as part of the commodities or food, the commods that they were provided. And so they adapted to those foods and took them in. And so they became a tradition and part of their food ways. And we come along and say, well, you shouldn't be eating those fried foods. And yet the impacts of the past carried forward. So there's just so much to learn and understand and try to recognize and help guide people to more healthful diets. But I can always, I think that the easiest place to make those changes in is in fruits and vegetables, and recognizing the kinds of plants that people might have grown in the past, and keep those coming and honor those traditions to today. Even if we do those, that kind of thing, we can make a lot of headway and try to understand and wade through all the rest.
If I could just add to that, because I think those are excellent examples and your comments, wonderful. Could you put, since you've had your experience of being in Pittsburgh today, pierogies on that list?
Okay. I have eaten pierogies. There are a few people in North Dakota that make pierogies too. can you share a little bit more about pierogies?
You want to add a little to the pierogi story?
I'm sorry.
Do you want to add a little to the pierogi story?
A pierogi story. Well, it's a, I've had recent examples of that where a conversation was going on about how to change, say, dietary menus and so forth in long-term care. And we would offer, you know, salads and braised fish, you can go on. And there would be this kind of quiet. And then especially, and I'm one of those among some of the elder persons, well, what about pierogies? And we said, well, is there something we could put in the pierogi that would be more healthy, you know, like a piece of salmon? And that went over like a lead balloon, but we did try.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love food stories. My husband worked way back at a residential facility for youth who were working through difficult situations in their lives. And he got this many cases of commodity canned salmon, and he made salmon patties. And the staff and residents were not too thrilled about the salmon patties. So they slid them down the antenna of his car that was parked at the facility.
So do we have another comment here in the chapel or online? If not, I'll give the last word to you, Karen.
Oh, to me. Oh, I would just like to say thank you. Even though I can't see you, it's been fun to connect with you and hear from you. And I wish you good success moving forward through the rest of your series. Thank you.
Thank you so much.